This is the Poetry Magazine podcast for July and August 2015. I'm Don Scher, editor of Poetry Magazine.
And I'm Lindsay Garbutt, assistant editor for the magazine. On the podcast, we listen to and talk about a few poems in the current issue. This month, we're going to hear from Amy Newman.
I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by wedding planners.
Alice Notley.
Everything once ever said, not quite true.
And Anthony Madrid.
There was an old person from Burnside, and his garden was good till his fern died.
I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness. Starving, hysterical, naked. Dragging themselves through the Negro streets at dawn, looking for an angry fix.
That's Allen Ginsberg reading Howl shortly after it was written, in 1955. 60 years later, in the current issue of Poetry, we're publishing another Howl.
This one is written by Amy Newman. When we asked her how she came to write her Howl, her answer began with Kerouac's On the Road.
I kept making a transition in my head when I'd read it. I'd think of Kerouac, and then I'd think of Neal Cassady, and then I'd land on Carolyn Cassady, usually, Neal's wife. You know, she cooked all those innumerable pots of spaghetti for these wanderers when they'd come back from the road. She raised the children. She didn't get to go on the road.
She also thought of something Sylvia Plath wrote in her journal.
She says something along the lines of, my great desire is to wander, my great desire is to mingle with barroom regulars and strangers. But she says something like, all of this is spoiled by the fact that I am a girl, a female supposedly in danger of assault at all times.
And then there was Ginsberg's Howl itself.
I wondered what it would be like to inhabit this great poem form created by a man that explores iconic male behavior, say, and explore instead female subject matter. See what surprises and discoveries I might make. So that's how it started. And I started with versions of myself and versions of my friends. And it kind of opened up to women in the contemporary world and women in the past. And it went from there.
The poem is dedicated to Toni Keller, an art student at Northern Illinois University, where Amy Newman teaches.
She went off campus one day to sketch, and she was brutally raped and murdered. And it was quite the thing for our community.
The poem's too long to play the whole thing on the podcast, but let's listen to the first few pages.
Howl, for Toni Keller. I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by wedding planners, dieting, in shapewear, dragging themselves in cute outfits through the freezer section for the semifreddo bender. Blessed, innovative cloister girl pinups, burning to know the rabbi of electricity and poverty, obedience, in the dream stick of opium and the green Wi-Fi fuse, who marveling and cramping and wired and allergic, lock themselves out of their apartments in the trenchant, imperfect delight of early day, who bared their minds to bar friends by the train in twilight, and saw tiny figures like fireflies, splendoring apartments Botoxed flat like canvas, who passed through universities with sensual indulgence, addicts devoted to the indefinite space of maps and science labs while the committees shifted paperwork, who left the university from a numbing homesickness for the res and the old alcoholic lover, family, father, temper, crack, methamphetamine birdsong, who galvanized an excitable need and microdermabrasioned, took the lonely exit ramp on the nature, constitution, and forces of matter, who failed their enzyme-multiplied immunoassay technique not once, but more than once, because some guy came into her room talking about publishing hash and vintage cardigans, drunk to the abdominals, looking for speed, crank, coke, and codeine, who took Molly and Mint and Motrin and Methaqualone, naked in the unhappy light of Saved by the Bell on the hotel flat screen. With spring of 1924, beautiful, imaginary, wheat stalk wanderlust, nylons travel hope, not allowed to explore alleys or ride the rails or hitchhike either because of the magnetic pink, and with all the years of training spread out boundless, the rules and safety tiresome before them. Paradise, papery, Wisconsin, Madison, visionary, blue-green, cross-hatched for elevation maps, baked, wild, open, unspoiled lands of Lake Kivu and Congo. Ardent, delirious, combustible desire to go astray, rove, stir, evolve, princess-like, who busted out against parents' wishes, clattered cross-country in a Model T with another girl to see the iron pyrite fool's gold, the West, and the finally wide open-legged Pacific zones, who wrote letters anyway to old boyfriends before setting out on the breathless orange high desert confusion with gold, carrying canvas buckets for the extra water for the car, who talked all night in the tourist camps and were up with the sun and snappish with hunger, the navigators in terror of the steep mountain road, refreshing the radiator with water, inhaling the rust steam fragrance of open road red oxygen metal and a lunar happiness, whistle-singing, bow-wowing, mooing at the glamorous elations of altitude and the hay burner, no, handcuff, no, hush money, open wang-doodle, fiery western sky, deposits of gold and silver, lost stories, gun-toting, candle-making, dance hall, prostitutes, stowaway freedoms, not to mention ball-bang, bareback, gamma-hoochie cowboy, who listened while the mechanic romanced over velocity and atonement die stampings on sheet steel and drop forgings, while the diner waitress ground out pies and pies and pies. Wandering nylon suffering while the word of engagements and new babies began its bone descent by mother's phrasing and martini lunch date with the old school of the hot comb and the inner ear, who broke up with boyfriends and walked tap heels on streets for dentist appointment, a doctor's appointment, an interview, a newspaper, grocery, dinner, tomato, who found the sublet, which for what she was making she could afford, but the roommate had trouble with rent, alarm clock, rooster cock boyfriend, who saw her clothing was available in size 00, so it was time to disappear entirely.
I was floored by this poem when I first saw it. The audacity of it isn't the least of it. You know, it's called Howl, and you can tell from the first few words what it's going to do. Mm-hmm. And you know, I was, of course, inclined to be dubious. You know, how is somebody going to do that? Because I was, like many people as a teenager discovering poetry, floored by Allen Ginsberg's Howl. And it's become one of those monuments, if not touchstones, of American poetry. So how can somebody come along and do something with it? So this poem by Amy Newman really just kind of equals the poem and in some ways really betters it, because it takes over from the original poem and it moves it into our own world. So it's not a pastiche. It's not a parody. It's not a critique of the original. It's as moving as the original, but in a very different way, something I don't think anyone would have predicted. You'd be surprised maybe that someone hasn't done this so well before.
You're right that it's amazing that no one has ever written this from a female perspective before. Mm-hmm. And I think it's fascinating the way Amy Newman does it. As she says in her sort of introduction, that, you know, women and girls have this desire to be on the road and to have freedoms, but they have their own restrictions and addictions too that prevent that from happening.
And in a very intelligent way, in the sense that you know she's done her homework, so that when you do, as one is inclined to do, want to read about these now legendary characters, and dismayingly the first thing you discover among them is their misogyny, how they used women and benefited from whatever they could get out of the women in their acquaintance. And so the myths and legends of literature are not any longer just tales told by men publicly for other men. Not only an intrinsically important thing to do and a corrective, but this is work that really stands on its own. When you get to the end of the poem with its beautiful evocation of the Kaddish, the prayer for the dead.
Yisgadal v'yisgadah shamei rabah, acanthus, world and dense and impossibly real, multiplying in fields, an abundance of sunflowers, serious beauty with blooming, ridiculous with blooming, arriving and opening in endless profusion forever.
It's a deft and poignant Ginsberg touch, but it's hers. This is never enslaved to or enslaved by Ginsberg's very masculinist diction.
Mm-hmm.
Every phrase is thought through, every aspect of the thinking that goes into what it's like to be someone different from the poets you admire comes together here brilliantly.
Yeah, and I think in addition to, you know, the visionary and the spiritual, there's also this bodily aspect of Howl in both Amy Newman's mm-hmm. and Ginsberg's version. I mean, that's part of what made it so shocking was mm-hmm. all the bodily fluids and all the, yeah. you know, shooting up and all that kind of thing. And one of the lines that made me laugh out loud when I first read it in Amy's was,
"Who is up nights and days peeing restlessly, endlessly with nothing but
cranberry Eucharist for the body's unyielding sciences and the UTI of the punishing boy god who decides who wins." That repetition of cranberry, 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 which is, you know, the famous blackberry, 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 but changed into this thing that almost every woman goes through.
Yeah. I mean, when it's funny, it's tender and funny, but genuinely funny too. Mm-hmm. So it's not po-faced, this poem. Even things like
"naked in the unhappy light of Saved by the Bell on the hotel flat screen."
It's sort of familiar all at once. And so much of its time, the way Howl was, that it almost preserves things about our life in a way that they'll feel alive to people forever after. To see this as a kind of mini epic of women taking their place in the world in a way that is fraught and difficult and dangerous and yet also inevitable and necessary. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. Since the early 1970s, Alice Notley has published some 30 books of poems. Her way of writing has been so various, it's all but impossible to characterize. We can say that behind the multiplicity of voices and visions in her writing, there's a capacious and heartening egalitarianism, much like Walt Whitman's, maybe even inherited from him, but channeled through a contemporary voice.
The Poetry Foundation recently awarded Alice Notley the Ruth Lilly Poetry Prize. The $100,000 prize honors a living U.S. poet whose lifetime accomplishments warrant extraordinary recognition. In the July-August issue of Poetry, we're publishing a portfolio of new Alice Notley poems, and we're going to hear one of them now.
The poem is called "This Fire."
"No one loves you more, more, more. There were sincere lies everywhere placed directly before the next step. Does everyone pretend part of a lie? I am proposing words. All structures have crumbled in earliest death. I'm crossing the yellow sands. It's so hard to know without relating it to you, shaping a heart. Take hold of me, and someone says, I don't get it. You don't have to have love, or you do, which I don't think you do. Before the explosion, I was here without it and have been in many places loveless. I don't want you to know what I'm really thinking, or do I? Before creation, when there might be no I knew. Everything one's ever said, not quite true. He or she betrays you. Why you want to hurt me? Bad. Want to, or just do? Treason was provoked everywhere, even here, by knowing one was one, and I was alone, a pale hue. The sky of death is milky green today, like a poison pool near a desert mine. Picked prickly pear fruit, and I tasted it. Then we drove on, maybe to Yarnell. These outposts where I grew up, I didn't do that. I have no identity. And the love is an object to kick as you walk on the blazing bare ground. Where? Sentimental when what I love, I don't have that one word. This fire, all there is to find, I find it. You have to find it. It isn't love. It's what?"
What a great ending.
And a beginning, too. I mean, one thing that's so remarkable and distinctive about her work, and I can't think of anybody else who quite does this, is that she takes, and I don't think this is part of anything that she intends to do, it's just how it strikes me, that she takes what we might think of as a kind of stream of consciousness, but it's not. It's a stream of poetry consciousness, mm-hmm. so that she's not transcribing thoughts that run through her mind or merely pulling in voices from everywhere, though she does do that. But she's orchestrating these things so that each phrase, each rhythmical and syntactical unit is sort of interrogating itself, and it sort of multiplies, and there are echoes of echoes of echoes, so that mm-hmm. she's making something that doesn't exist anywhere but in her poetry. It's not just thoughts or thinking. It's not just, you know, snippets of what's going on in the world. It is really bringing to life something that we talk about all the time or pay lip service to, which is having the language speak itself. And so that everything strikes one as a kind of illumination or revelation, but it might not be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she backs off from being pompous that way.
Yeah.
So there's a kind of great modesty in this work, but also great strength, too, in the insistence of the rhythms. And they all play around this idea of how you're supposed to have an identity, which means what? You know, who is, if you have an identity, who is speaking for you and in you? And you never know.
It's so hard to know without relating it to you shaping a heart. Take hold of me. And someone says, I don't get it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love what you said about those echoes and the way that it might be one way or not. And the way she goes back and forth over that. And to me, that becomes really apparent in the way that it is echoed throughout the poem. She keeps saying it, but you don't know what it refers to.
It could be this fire, but it might not be.
It could be love, but it might not be. It could be the picked prickly pear fruit, or might not be. Mm-hmm. And I think that is what really opens up the poem to the reader's own interpretation, but also to play a sort of equal role to the poet, I think.
Before creation, when there might be no I knew, everything one's ever said, not quite true.
She makes a statement that you're like, oh, that is so true, and then immediately says, oh, but it might not be true.
And not only that, the powerhouse of the poem is kind of the questioning. And you can hear that when she reads these poems. When there's a question, it's really forceful.
You don't have to have love, or you do, which I don't think you do.
It's really remarkable, and of course, the ending.
This fire, all there is to find, I find it. You have to find it. It isn't love. It's what?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's really remarkable. I think there are a few poets who kind of master this question. Yeats is one of them. I mean, Yeats's poems are full of questions. But what's sort of distinctive here is that these are questions that have no conceivable answer, and that's why she must ask them.
And what's striking in those last three lines is how every word after sentimental is just one syllable, mm-hmm. which makes it hit kind of like a bunch of darts or something that seems very declarative and simple, but is in fact entirely open-ended.
Yeah. Well, because even she says, you know, I, and then there's an ellipsis, I don't have that one word.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that sums up the poet's work right there. A poet is somebody who doesn't have that one word. And now for something completely different.
There was a young lady whose eyes were unique as to color and size. When she opened them wide, people all turned aside and started away in surprise.
That, of course, is a classic limerick by Edward Lear, read here by Anthony Madrid.
It's not funny. It's just delightful.
Anthony Madrid is a poet who lives here in Chicago. His first collection of poems, I'm Your Slave, Now Do What I Say, came out in 2012. Shortly thereafter, he started writing limericks, lots of limericks.
And it was a solid year. And I can tell you the year. 2013, I wrote something like 350 limericks. And then at the urging of every single person who knew me and cared about me, I stopped.
So what's wrong with all these people? I mean, who doesn't like limericks?
They just like, at first, people thought it was really fun and charming that I was doing it. And they're like, oh, these are so fun. Like, people were egging me on. But there's only so many that people could take unless you seriously have the disease.
Anthony Madrid says people with limerick disease fall into three distinct categories. There are those who only like dirty limericks, those who only like witty limericks, and those who like only boneheaded limericks. Madrid himself goes in for the boneheaded ones.
Boneheaded ones are just completely stupid, pointless exercises in just that rhythm, just enjoying the rhythm and saying something more or less pointless.
And it's Edward Lear who's the model for this spirited nonsense.
It's really all about that second line for me. The first line is sort of galloping, and then I like the second line to be like a speeded up film of galloping. There was a young lady whose eyes were unique as to color and size, that.
Without further ado, here are six limericks by Anthony Madrid in the July-August issue.
There was an old man with a backpack. Nobody could beat him at blackjack. When they said let us win, he would finger his chin and then beat him to pieces at blackjack. There was an old man from El Paso, and his rodeo stunt was to lasso a gazelle and a buck, load him into a truck, and then pass through the tolls of El Paso. There was an old person from Burnside, and his garden was good till his fern died. He threw at a funeral and said, play a tune or I'll sink in despair since my fern died. There was an old man from Lesage who was making a Bible collage, but he needed a scissor because Nebuchadnezzar looked more like the Wizard of Oz. There was an old person from Evanston, and he certainly wasn't a pleasant one. When we said, "What's your deal?" he replied, "I just feel that you people are boring and meddlesome." There was an old person from Bucktown who was filling his pillow with duck down, so he snatched up a wad and then using a rod started priming that pillow with duck down.
Do you have a favorite, Don?
No, they're all great. We could do whole issues of these things. You know, there's a serious point here, which I think readers can explore in Anthony's introduction to these limericks in the pages of the magazine, because, you know, he goes on a lot about what's happening here. And it's quite interesting. A lot of times we get asked, why don't we publish more poems that rhyme? And the answer is that most people aren't any good at it anymore. And I think this is really where Anthony Madrid is coming from. It's a subject he's always been dissolved in, for lack of a better word. And he explores this both in his little essay and, of course, in the limericks. But he mentions at one point in the introduction that what he calls his rhyme praxis, he says, is tainted with modern assumptions about rhyme, which is that rhymes ought to make some show of originality, that they ought to be admirable in themselves. And he sort of pinpointed a real problem that people contend with when they attempt to write in the great tradition of rhymed verse in contemporary times. So he exploits this problem, and it is very funny, as you heard, but it's also a very serious question.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, because of the commitment to the boneheaded stuff, which is why they're delightful too, you can't think too hard about it. It'll just make your boneheaded head hurt.
Yeah, I mean, I think my favorite one, if I had to choose, would be the Burnside one about the fern.
There was an old person from Burnside, and his garden was good till his fern died. He threw it a funeral and said, play a tune or I'll sink in despair since my fern died.
And as Madrid says in his intro, it's the kind of rhyme that, in his words, Lear wouldn't have touched awake or asleep, drunk or on acid.
Right.
Because to rhyme funeral with play a tuneral or all, it's really hard to even say that properly, is so amusing. But what's really amusing is the idea of a man being so much in despair from a fern dying. And that, I think, is what Anthony gets across in his introduction, is that not only is it the fun to say-ness of these rhymes, but it's also the surprise that can happen regardless of whether the mm-hmm. rhyme is an original rhyme or not. And
yeah.
That's why Lear's limericks are so entertaining. It's not the rhyme itself. It's the image and the self-containedness.
Right. And one thing that needs to be pointed out is that Lear's limericks don't just exist as verse forms. As everybody knows, he was a gifted artist, and his limericks were accompanied by visual things. And so are these, so that when you see them in the pages of Poetry Magazine, you'll see incredible illustrations by Mark Fletcher.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I had to pick a favorite from this bunch, the one I like is about the old person from Bucktown who was filling his pillow with duck down.
So he snatched up a wad and then using a rod started priming that pillow with duck down.
And the illustration shows the old person sort of using that ramrod to prime a pillow with duck down. And so what's sort of upping the ante and quite marvelous in its own right is this illustration that so literally takes the improbable action of the limerick and shows what it would look like if it really happened. And it's very funny. And it's funny because the literalness is so awkward and surprising and weird.
Mm-hmm.
So here the form of the limerick is all about making the incongruous probable but not likely. And so that's kind of what you can see as these illustrations accompany the limericks. You can read Anthony Madrid's limericks and everything else you heard on this podcast in the July-August 2015 issue of Poetry Magazine or online at poetrymagazine.org.
Let us know what you thought of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org.
The Poetry Magazine podcast is recorded by Ed Herman and produced by Curtis Fox.
The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Lindsay Garbett.
And I'm Don Scher. Thanks for listening.